Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome everyone. We have an eclectic and interesting show for you all today, and we're going to start things off by looking at the intersection of two challenging policy areas, higher education and the debate over immigration reform. Joining us for that discussion is one of the nation's higher education leaders, Dr. Stephen Jordan, who is the president of Metropolitan University of Denver. He's done some great things in his 5 years there, helping the university become a Hispanic-serving institution and growing their role as an urban land-grant institution. So, Dr. Jordan, welcome to the show. And let's start a little bit in the area that's a big one for higher education, and that's what do you do for undocumented students? I know that Metropolitan State University basically went out of their way to create a special tuition rate for those students. Tell us a little bit about what you did, why you did it, and what the result has been.
Sure. It's been an issue in Colorado for more than 11 years where there have been efforts to pass legislation to provide in-state tuition for undocumented students. Six different times it's come up for a vote, and our university has supported that legislation from the first time it was introduced to the last time it was introduced. And up until 3 years ago, we were the only institution to support it. Our institution, you have to understand, I think, the history of Colorado and of this campus to have a great appreciation for why this was important. First of all, Colorado has a long history of Hispanic immigrants, going back 300 years of Hispanics living in Colorado. From the early settlements, and this campus actually was the site of the Hispanic Barrio in Denver, created largely by Mexicans immigrating, fleeing the Mexican Revolution, taking the train from El Paso to Denver and settling in lower downtown Denver on the east side or the west side. And and so this was the Hispanic Barrio in the late 1960s. The city and county of Denver did an urban renewal project, or the state did, and literally took that west side Hispanic community's home away from them in order to create the Auraria campus. This was the site of the first Catholics, Spanish-speaking Catholic church in Denver. And a number of Hispanic restaurants and other things. So strong roots of the Hispanic community on this site that is today Metropolitan State University of Denver. When the legislature was considering the bill a year ago to provide in-state tuition, we went to our board with a proposal that essentially said, we want to support the legislation all the way through the session. But if it were to fail, would they be willing to consider a proposal that would allow us to create a special non-resident rate? And that was an important distinction. A special non-resident rate that was much more affordable than our traditional non-resident rate, that would be applicable only to undocumented students who had gone to Colorado high schools, attended those high schools for at least 3 years, and who had graduated from that high school or subsequently got a GED and then enrolled in an institution of higher education. We created the rate by essentially looking at what did it cost us to provide education to our students? What was the total cost of education? And then so that there was no state subsidy involved in the tuition rate, because that's clearly what the bills had been about. It had been about allowing students to have in-state rates. It was clear that the legislature had rejected that. So we calculated the cost of education, and then we said, since the state provides the physical facilities, the students need to have, we need to have a proxy for that so that students are also paying for the capital costs. And we set that proxy at 10% of the cost of education and established a rate that was about $7,300. That compared to our non-resident rate of $16,000. So a significant discounting of the rate. And our board, and we waited until the legislature had defeated the bill. Literally the last week of the session, the bill to provide for in-state tuition rates was defeated. So we supported up until then, and then we went to work in putting together this tuition rate. Our board adopted it in June of a year ago, and we essentially had from the 7th of June till the 1st of August to register students under that new rate.
Very good. And tell us a little bit about has enrollment increased? Is there a change in your student population?
Yeah, I think we've been amazed with how young people have responded for two reasons. First of all, there was that very short time frame for them to register, and when the fall semester began, we had 258 students registered under that tuition rate in that very short period of time. And so one, we were surprised by their how many students enrolled in a very short period of time. But what made it more surprising was when we adopted that rate, the president had not yet made his announcement about deferral of prosecution and the availability of work permits for these young people.
Interesting.
The president actually made that announcement a week after we passed our rate. But if you will recall, right after he made the announcement, the administration then said, and we're going to have a hiatus until about the middle of August in which we work through the processes, before we're going to establish what the process is going to be. And so these students had to actually take a risk that in registering under that rate, not knowing exactly what was going to happen at the federal level.
Gotcha. Well, talk to me. So everyone's attention is focused on immigration at the federal level, but state legislatures can do a lot, especially with undocumented students. So talk to us a little bit about what the Colorado State legislature has done recently.
Sure. As I said, our legislature has considered this concept over 11 years, six different times. This year, the legislature brought the bill back again, but in a slightly different form. They brought it back with three critical provisions. The first was that these students could pay an in-state tuition rate, which was similar to last year. But the second and different component was that, in addition, the state would also send to the institution the state subsidy for those students. And then the third component, which was also new, was that while the state said that these students still are not eligible for either federal aid or state-based financial aid, they would be eligible for institutional aid. And almost every institution in Colorado has a significant program of tuition set-asides for need-based financial aid, including our institution. It has been probably the single fastest-growing part of our budget has been the increase in institutionally-based aid from tuition set-asides. So these students are now eligible to receive in-state tuition. They have the state subsidy that comes in support of them, and they are now eligible for institutionally based financial aid. Very significant change. You know, there are two things I think happened that made that possible. One, I think the action that we took, because it garnered so much attention nationally and locally, it really, really started a significant public discussion about these kinds of young people who were brought here, you know, through no fault of their own, who are doing the right thing, going to an trying to get an education, want to be a part of the community that they were literally raised in, the only home that they've ever known. And so I think that there was this really significant debate. It got brought into the legislative process, and legislators on both sides of the aisle were taking positions on it, during the legislative election process here in Colorado. Colorado had a significant, change in the legislature. Prior to the last election, the, Democrats had controlled the Senate, the Republicans had controlled the House, and as you know, we have a Democratic governor. During this election, the Democrats took both houses, and not by small margins, but by pretty significant margins. I think the Democrats felt that they really saw that this was going to be their year, their opportunity to pass state legislation.
Well, let me come back to the federal level. Dr. Jordan, let me come back to the federal level. And as you know, Congress is working on immigration reform. They've just unveiled this draft legislation that's going to move first through the Senate. Give us your thoughts on those efforts. And I know we were talking offline. You obviously have been engaged with your senators. So talk to us a little bit about their perspective and how you're dealing with them.
Sure. So, as you know, and I think your listeners know, our senator, Senator Bennett, is a member of the infamous Gang of Eight, and he's a very accessible legislator. So we have certainly been meeting with the senator and his staff. We have from the beginning understood that there are lots of compromises that would be necessary to get a comprehensive immigration reform. But the argument that we were making to the senator from the get-go was that whatever those compromises are about a path to citizenship and the timelines that they would put in for a path to citizenship for undocumented individuals, it was our view that it was absolutely essential that that these dreamers be given a preferential position in the line for documentation and ultimately citizenship, that these are young people who were trying to do it the right way, who clearly were going to become significant contributors to our economy. There needed to be a reward for them in that process. And you know, I think clearly you see that the legislation acknowledges that. It does give a preferential position to dreamers. They're not the only ones. There were others, and we understood that there would be others as we talked with the senator. But I think we were greatly heartened to see that when it was released that there was that preferential position for all dreamers.
Gotcha. Well, Dr. Jordan, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Our guest has been Dr. Stephen Jordan, who's the president of Metropolitan University of Denver. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and switch gears and talk about health care policy right after this here on Capital Thinking.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're going to switch gears and take a look at healthcare. Joining us is one of the crack healthcare policy associates from Patton Boggs' Washington, D.C. office, Caitlin McCormick. And Caitlin spends her time advising clients on healthcare, legislative, and regulatory matters. And she is here to talk a little bit about a seminar that she's going to be hosting called The Road Ahead in Healthcare. And we will use, Caitlin, every bad transportation road metaphor we can to discuss this segment. So tell us a little bit about the open road ahead in healthcare. What do you have planned?
Absolutely. Well, the open road ahead is certainly bumpy, but we hope to help you guys navigate it. I hope that fits the bill for using every bad metaphor I can. We're very excited about this event. It's coming up next week, and it's going to be on April 25th from 12:30 to 2 o'clock here at Patton Boggs. And we are hosting it here by our healthcare and our investigations group. So it's really going to be a two-part panel. First, Senator Breaux is going to open the seminar speaking about the current political climate and what it means for the healthcare industry, really what kind of healthcare clients and folks in the industry are facing kind of on a political landscape level. Then we're going to have one of our panels here to discuss the regulatory implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Now, the Affordable Care Act, or the ACA, you might hear me call it, that's the health reform bill that was passed back in 2010, and really it's kind of been a very slow process for implementation, partially because the Supreme Court was still waiting to hear the case up until last summer. Now that we're really moving ahead with implementation, there's an awful lot going on, so really want to look at what those issues are going to be in the upcoming years, kind of where we stand and what's really going to be important for companies who are facing these types of issues. This panel is going to include some of our experts here, like Lou Zivistovich. She's recently returned to Patton Boggs from kicking off the Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission, that's MACPAC. We're also going to be featuring Marty Kendrick and Karen Teal, two of our partners here who've really been on the front line of ACA implementation through the last several years. They're going to cover topics like the new health insurance exchanges that the states are setting up now, the essential health benefits package and how that's taking shape, Medicaid expansion, which is going to be a really important issue for all sorts of healthcare providers because it's really going to go to coverage for different types of services and items. I'm also going to talk a lot about taxes and fees that were included in the ACA that are going to be taking effect soon. It was a really big bill, and I think at the time there was just a lot in there people didn't really realize was there, but that's going to be affecting businesses, bottom line, and we're going to go over some of those issues as well.
Nice, nice. Well, tell us, so you've gone through some of the speakers. Tell us a little bit about who should be the interested parties in attending and what you think they get out of it.
Absolutely. So this is really an event for all employers. Like I said, we're going to talk not just about healthcare issues, but issues that affect employers, you know, taxes that they might be facing, things that are going to impact coverage that they're offering to their employees, going to impact the cost of coverage that they offer to their employees. So it's really something that's got a little bit for everything. Of course, we're particularly focused on healthcare companies, provider groups, patient advocacy groups, coalitions of those types of providers, and other entities that work in the healthcare space. Those are probably going to be the folks who are going to find the most relevant stuff here, but there's a little bit for everybody.
Excellent. All right. Well, give me maybe the easy information on where I can go for somebody who wants to actually sign up.
Absolutely. It's really easy to sign up. First of all, you can certainly always just come by Patton Boggs on the 25th around 12:30 and come on in. Don't have to sign up in advance. We'd certainly love you to if you can. If you do want to RSVP, you can email Katie Yost here at Patton Boggs. That's K-I-O-B-S-T at Patton Boggs, PattonBoggs.com. And you can also give her a call at 202-457-5681.
Nice. Okay. So, and if I can't come in person, is there a way to participate via webinar or anything like that?
Yes, absolutely. This is for everybody, not just those of you who are based out of D.C. We really want this to be an event that everybody can come and participate in. If you can't attend in person, you can just, again, RSVP to Katie, and she will get you all set up for a webcast that we'll be hosting during the event.
So, Caitlin, you mentioned at the beginning you used the bumpy road analogy, and yesterday, kind of surprising news that Max Baucus, the Senate Finance Chairman, a Democrat who helped oversee the development and implementation of this law, was very critical to HHS Secretary Sebelius as she was testifying before his committee about the pace of implementation, and basically said, hey, this could be a train wreck, therefore keeping our transportation metaphor going here. What do you think was behind his concerns? Unpack that a little bit for us.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people have been frustrated about the pace of implementation. I think there's been a lot of different factors contributing to it. One was the uncertainty that surrounded the ACA for so long. Until the Supreme Court's decision, there was a lot of people who were basically saying that it was a doomed law. There was no way it was ever going to stand up, and it was just a matter of time before the Supreme Court turned it over. A lot of people who had that opinion really didn't want to waste any time or energy or resources doing implementation. So some of the states that were led by folks who really didn't believe in the ACA really were not kind of lifting a finger to move forward with implementation. So that's certainly been a big factor. The other factor has just been, like I said, there's just so much there. It was a very big bill. There's a lot of major changes, but there's also a lot of minor, not minor in that they're not important, but, you know, in the scope of the number of regulations that have to get put out, there's just a lot there, and there's a fairly limited staff still at HHS. So I think there's just kind of a sheer volume factor that's contributing as well. And I think Democrats are getting frustrated because they want to see this sort of thing. They want to see things get up and running. They want to see things working well. They don't want to have uncertainty and problems lingering that might make the ACA look like maybe not the best effort and not really kind of the ultimate solution that Democrats want it to be.
We'll go back to the seminar that you guys are going to do. Talk to us about some of the other challenges you think you guys will get in depth in at the seminar.
Absolutely. Well, I was able to talk a little bit about our first panel, but we also have another panel that is very critical to healthcare clients. And this is going to be looking at enforcement trends in healthcare. Now, this is something that's a very significant trend over the last 10 years, and particularly in the last few years, is there's just a lot more enforcement and oversight activity going in healthcare. Period. We're going to look at a couple different sources of enforcement and oversight, both congressional activity as well as activity at the Department of Justice and the Office of the Inspector General that really are doing a lot of that kind of fraud and abuse and audit enforcement and activity. And here we're going to talk about things like the role of compliance. Compliance programs are something that's really critical to healthcare programs. They're really, you know, expected to have them, even if it's not required. They can help companies stay out of trouble, and if a company gets into trouble, they can help mitigate everything. So we're going to talk about that, what a compliance program should look like and the role that it plays. And then we're also going to talk about trends in investigations and enforcement, both at the DOJ, the OIG, and also some upcoming congressional oversight issues that we think folks are likely to see in the upcoming year.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little more in depth. I know that's one of your areas of expertise in particular. It seems like more and more you look at enforcement and you look at fraud, waste, and abuse. That's a profit center that ACA has to capitalize on in order to make it affordable, part of the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely. I mean, the dollar value return on investment that's been coming out of the DOJ and OIG is pretty astounding. I think the president's budget was saying somewhere between $7 to $8 per dollar spent. So this is really something that the administration is very focused on, because they see it as a potential revenue driver to kind of return money into the system, as well as kind of trying to plug the hole so that the money doesn't go out of the system in the first place. But it's something that congressional Democrats and Republicans have also had a significant impact, interest in, both because of the potential, budgetary impact, but also on the Republican standpoint, they're very interested in kind of, making sure that Medicare and particularly Medicaid are, run and administered in a proper manner. So they're very concerned about areas where there might not be sufficient oversight to catch fraud and abuse issues. So this is an issue that's kind of resonated on both sides of the aisle.
And are there any other things that you think between now and there's obviously so many implementation hurdles and milestones this year and then going into 2014, are there any other big surprises you think coming up that you guys will be talking about in the seminar?
I don't know that there are necessarily big surprises that might happen between now and the seminar, but I think the major thing that we're going to be seeing is kind of how the exchange process plays out over the course of the next year. Those exchanges are really supposed to be getting up and running in the course of the next year or two, and that's going to have a really significant impact on folks who are looking for an insurance coverage, on folks who are trying to offer insurance coverage through those exchanges, trying to help people be what's called a navigator, maybe to help people get signed up. That's a real core component of the ACA, and that the next year and the following year after that are going to be big years for that. So I think that's definitely something that could have a lot of surprises down the road for us.
Interesting. Well, hit us again with the where, what, when, on how to register for the seminar before we wrap up.
Absolutely. It's called The Road Ahead in Healthcare. We're hosting it here at Patton Boggs at our offices at 2550 M Street, Washington, D.C. That's next Thursday, April 25th from 12:30 to 2 o'clock. And you can show up or you can RSVP by emailing kiobst@pattonboggs.com or calling 202-457-5681, and we'd be delighted to see you there.
And Caitlin, give folks your email address if they want to follow up with you about items under your expertise.
Absolutely. That's C. McCormick, C-M-C-C-O-R-M-I-C-K at pattonboggs.com.
Terrific. Well, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back and talk about some other areas in workforce development. Keep it here for more Capital Thinking.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, one of the areas that Washington is increasingly interested in is workforce development. It's a critical area as we get people trained for the jobs of the future. Brings together a couple different policy sectors, and we're going to be joined today by one of the experts in that area, Dr. Anand Gramapati, who is with the Clemson University Center for Workforce Development. Dr. Gramapati has a PhD in industrial engineering and human factors, and he is the chair of Clemson's Department of Industrial Engineering, as well as their associate vice president for the Clemson Center for Workforce Development. So, Dr. Gramapati, first, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about how the Center for Workforce Development got started and what its focus is.
Thank you for having me. The Clemson Center for Workforce Development is a Commission of Higher Education-approved statewide initiative to improve workforce educational capacity in STEM fields across South Carolina. Sort of, it embodies a new national model that engages university, technical colleges, K-12 institutions, statewide industry partners, and federal agencies to deliver workforce development tools that have the power to transform the economy of the state. And the way it got started was with funding from the Department of Labor and Department of Energy, Department of Education, and the National Science Foundation through various separate centers and grant initiatives. So what we are doing as part of this center is look at the entire supply chain pipeline that affects the workforce development capacity, the kind of systemic transformation of workforce and economic opportunities is only effective if it is implemented from lowest to the highest levels, and recognizing that capacity building is a multi-layered investment. And that has been our focus. How do we engage various partners throughout the state? And as a higher education institution, how do we partner with K-12 technical colleges, statewide agencies, and federal agencies for maximum impact? And while doing so, listen to industry. Look what their needs are. Look what's coming in the future, and prepare for it now.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I know part of your mission statement for the Center for Workforce Development really focuses on developing professionals in the so-called STEM areas, science, technology, education, math. So talk to us about the evolving need for that workforce and what it is in particular you all do for them.
And if you look, you mentioned STEM areas. We have seen a tremendous resurgence of manufacturing in South Carolina. This is not the same manufacturing. It's advanced manufacturing. It's a different kind of manufacturing environment. It involves robotics. It involves mechatronics. It involves big data. It involves use of visualization and simulation tools. So it involves digital manufacturing. It involves clean manufacturing. It involves lightweighting, composites. So it's a completely different manufacturing environment which requires tremendous expertise coming from the science and engineering disciplines, from STEM fields. So with that said, what we in the center look at is we call as the four pillars of the center. The first one is digital learning, looking at providing digital tools to access information. You have heard about the role of MOOCs. You have heard about the role of online learning. That's the first one. Next is how can we create career pathways and support college education and affordability and improve graduation? How can we create stackable certificates to improve credentials of our citizens? Next one is how can we partner on various initiatives with K-12 education institutions, because that's where it starts, starting with middle schools and much earlier even elementary schools. And finally, if you're going to do all of that, the fourth pillar is how do we get the industry engaged through networking, through job fairs, through holding conferences, so that we can share the information that comes from industry to all the different partners.
Interesting, interesting. Well, I know you have some federally funded projects. One of them is ASSIST, the other is CA2VES. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what those two projects are focused on?
Let me first speak about what we call as a CAVE. And the idea over here is CAVE stands for the Center for Automotive and Aviation Virtual E-Schools. Automotive and aviation, because those are the two biggest knowledge clusters in our state. There's big manufacturing associated with that. If you look at BMW, Michelin, and now Boeing, given that National Science Foundation, through the Advanced Technological Education Program, funded us to partner with K-12 technical colleges to look at how can we bring visualization and simulation tools to improve online and digital learning. And not only look at coming up with those tools, but also doing an assessment of those tools. Does it actually transfer into improved skills performance on the job? What is the acceptance? What will be the our ability to deliver those tools to a rural population and geographically dispersed population? And that's the primary focus on of CAVES through the NSF ATE program. The ASSIST Consortium grant is essentially the one that was funded through the Department of Labor TACT grant initiative. And what it stands for is the Accessible Support Services and Instruction for Sustainable Transition. The grant unites 10 technical colleges across the state, Clemson University, Center for Workforce Development, local workforce investment boards, the South Carolina Commission of Minority Affairs, South Carolina National Guards, adult education, and businesses. And the idea over here is how can we catalyze economic recovery and growth in South Carolina and foster a systemic change within the higher education technical college system paradigm.
Nice, nice. Well, talk to us a little bit about, besides the federal government, I know you've got a wide array of companies from Fortune 500s down to mom-and-pop shops that are partnering with the Clemson Center for Workforce Development. So walk us through a little bit of that.
So we partner across the state with companies such as BMW, companies such as General Electric, companies such as Michelin, Boeing. And the idea over here is these are the companies and their tier one manufacturers and their suppliers who are, as you mentioned, the mom and pop shops. And the idea is, interestingly, the mom and pop shops employ a large percentage of our citizens. And the question is, what are the skill sets that are required for them to be successful? How can we work with our K-12 partners to make sure that they not only have the general competencies, but they also have the math skills and the technology skills and the science skills? How can we ensure that they are ready to hit the ground running? And while doing so, what is expected as part of the next generation of curriculum? What kind of career fair training is required? What kind of on-the-job training is required? What kind of apprenticeship program we need to put into place? So we are looking at different facets of the education, and beyond education while joining industry, what is a lifelong learning experience that they should be experiencing so that they keep on walking through the career pathway as they are working in a specific industry?
All right, very good. We'll talk about some of the resources that are at your disposal there at Clemson.
So the way we work not only with the academic departments and faculty on campus and the graduate students and the various innovation campuses. We work in the upstate, we work at the CU ICARP, and the PD area, we have facilities as SIMT in the technical college environment. And in the low country, we work at the Clemson University Restoration Institute. The idea is how can we not just partner with Clemson, but also partner with statewide organizations such as South Carolina's Coalition for Mathematics and Science, which has representatives through the entire school, through all the school districts within the state. The Youth Learning Institute is another example, where they hold camps and they look at STEM workshops. They, in fact, impact about 140,000 kids every year through their out-of-class experiences. And obviously, the industry partners, which are a key component of what we do. Because as the industry is changing, as things are changing, we see that the skill sets keep on changing. The skill sets are getting more complex. So having a strong industry contingent is very important. But we have not just been local. We also partner with centers outside the state. We partner with CARCAM in Alabama. We partner with Macomb Community College outside. And we partner with other federal agencies to make sure that we look what the best practices are happening nationally and can bring them to our own state.
Very good. Well, so let's talk about that nationally. And what do you see as the future for workforce development, things Congress and the administration could do that would help you both in South Carolina, but would also make a big impact on the national scale?
So when we look at what we have done over here, and I don't want to use bragging points, but the model that we have used where a higher education institution is partnering with K-12, is partnering with technical colleges, with partnering with industry, and there is tremendous dialogue taking place across the entire consortium partners. And that is a need. It is important that if we are going to do workforce development, that as higher education institution partner through the entire pipeline of education. And only then we will have maximum impact. Clearly, we see a lot of that happening through our center, but there is a need that this model is taken nationally. It is important that the federal government looks at this model and says, that is a good model that we should continue funding because that has tremendous synergies. It has greater impact. And what it does is it avoids duplication of resources. And I believe the federal government should use this as an example to see how different institutions with different missions can come together for the common good.
Very good. Well, as we wrap up, Doctor, why don't you give folks a little bit of information on where they can find out more about the Clemson Center for Workforce Development?
So if you the one way to get to Clemson Center for Workforce Development is on Clemson's webpage, and if you do CUCWD, which stands for Clemson University Center for Workforce Development, on the search page, you can get there. Or the website is www.clemson.edu/centers-institute/CUCWD. Or you can reach us directly at 864-656-4716. Or you can drop me a note at agramop@clemson.edu.
Very good. Well, we've been joined by Dr. Anand Gramapati from the Clemson Center for Workforce Development. We're going to come back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we're continuing our discussion from recently about generic top-level domains. We're talking with two Patton Boggs attorneys, Deborah Lodge, who frequently appears on the show and specializes in intellectual property and privacy issues. Also joining us is Chris Adams, an associate in the Patton Boggs D.C. office, and a part of our intellectual property group where he works on patent prosecution, licensing, and litigation matters. So, Chris, welcome. Deborah, welcome back. Deborah, let's start with you. When last we met, we talked a little bit about top-level domains. Last week, we talked about the Trademark Clearinghouse. And it's been several months since we talked a little bit about these top-level domains and the reveal day when we knew who bid what. So talk to us about what's happened in the interim.
Yes, a lot's been happening in the interim, and I'm delighted to be back on Capital Thinking. As you'll remember, almost 2,000 applications for top-level domain names were submitted to ICANN about a year ago. And ICANN, of course, is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. We think of it as the Internet traffic cop, making sure that, you know, the traffic on the Internet goes where it's supposed to. So ICANN's been reviewing these applications and making sure that the applicants have enough, you know, technical and financial backup to really operate the new generic top-level domains. And remember, we're talking about things like .patentbogs and many additions to the .com, .net, .org domains that we're used to. Last June, on Reveal Day, all these applications were made public, and that triggered an objections period. And up until March 12th, formal objections could be leveled against these applications, and they were recently made public.
Very good. Well, Chris, talk to us about the objections that actually exist.
Okay. ICANN has four main objections. The first would be a legal rights objection, and this can be brought by someone who holds a legal right, such as a trademark. And this objection pertains to an applied for top-level domain string that violates the legal rights of the objector. You also have what's called a string confusion objections, and this can be brought by anyone who either owns an existing a registered top-level domain or someone who's applying for a top-level domain. And this objection pertains to a string that is similar to an existing string or to one that's being applied for in this process. The third one is a community objection, and this can be brought by any entity that's established within a clearly delineated community. So, for example, a community could be maybe colleges or universities. And this pertains to, this objection pertains to top-level domain strings that, that are targeted towards a community and significant portion of that community has an objection to the string. The last one is a limited public interest objection, where anyone can file this objection, but abusive or frivolous objections will be filtered out by a dispute resolution service provider. And this basically applies to any string that contradicts any general norms of morality and public order recognized under international law.
Interesting. All right, Deborah, I got to ask. So string confusion sounds like something that happens to me 3 or 4 times a day and is a symptom of old age. That can't be what it is. What's it really mean?
Yeah, well, you know, in this context, it means that, a string is really what the domain's going to be. And it occurs when more than one applicant has applied for the same one. For instance, and I'm looking at some right now, where there are, several applicants for .cars. That's one sense. And then it can also be if there's a technical reason, behind the domain that exists because of ICANN. So anyway, all these objections got filed by March 12th, and now we're into the arbitration period because there's now going to be a dispute resolution mechanism to decide, really who gets what among the competing domains.
Okay. Very good. So what's a legal rights objection then?
Legal rights is basically a trademark infringement. For instance, if somebody had applied for Doc Gucci, who does not control or own the Gucci trademarks, then Gucci could, bring a legal rights objection on that basis.
Very good. All right. So, Chris, earlier you mentioned that the deadline has passed for filing objections. So what are the next steps?
Well, the next steps would be a review of the application, the objections by what ICANN by dispute resolution service providers that ICANN has selected. We call those DRSPs for short. For the string confusion, it will be ICDR. For the legal rights objection, it would be the World Intellectual Property Organization. And for community objections and limited public interest objections, it will be the International Chamber of Commerce. Another thing to note, the fees for this, ICANN has estimated the fees for this process at approximately $50,000 per objection.
Wow, that's a lot. That is not cheap. Well, talk to us a little bit, Chris, about the objection proceedings and how that will go.
Well, after the objection period closed in March 13th, the next step would be the dispute resolution service providers would perform an administrative review of that process that will typically be completed by mid-April. Most of them have been completed. After that, ICANN will post a dispute announcement, which will show all the objections that have passed the administration. This week and potentially next week, applicants will start receiving a formal notification from the dispute resolution service providers, and that's when their 30-day clock for the response to the objections actually start.
All right. And, Deborah, what about the response timing?
Yeah, and that's where we are right now for many of these, because the list of the disputed, the ones that have been submitted recently was posted by ICANN, and each applicant has 30 days after the formal notification to respond. They're expected to submit a point-by-point response to each objection, and they have to also pay the hearing fees, which, as Chris mentioned, and all these other fees are very quite steep, actually. And the substantive portion of the response is limited to 20 pages, and if the applicant doesn't file a response in a timely manner, then the objector will prevail, and the domain name the application will be denied.
All right. And Chris, who will assess those objections?
The objections will be assessed by a panel of experts selected by the DRSPs. The experts would be arbitrators, typically subject matter experts that have significant experience in the arena.
All right. And then, Deborah, going forward, will there be additional submissions after all this?
You know, that's really up to the panel. Because, you know, as Chris mentioned, the panel's going to be experts in the field and others who are selected by the dispute service providers. The panel's going to decide whether the parties will submit any written statements in addition to the objections and the responses. Evidence is extremely limited. In exceptional cases, the panel may ask the parties to provide additional evidence, but that's really not expected.
All right. And, Chris, will we see hearings out of all this?
Typically, most of the disputes will be resolved without a hearing. However, the panel may decide on its own initiative to request a hearing. And if the panel decides to hold a hearing, then they'll decide the logistics for the hearing, and they will likely adhere to practices that will minimize cost on both the applicant and the objector.
And Deborah, if there are hearings, what will happen after all that?
Well, after the hearings and after, you know, the panel reviews everything, then there's going to be the expert determination issued. The goal for the issuance of the expert dispute resolution providers' expert determinations, how's that for a mouthful, will be within 45 days of the appointment of the panel. So assuming that the panels are appointed in June, which is the current schedule, that would be by mid-August. And the expert determination is going to identify who wins and will state the reasons upon which the decision is based. And there are very limited remedies that are available to an applicant or an objector. Basically, it's whether or not the objection is well taken and whether or not the application will go forward.
And what if I'm a party and I don't agree with this expert determination, Chris?
Well, I think we're still waiting to find out what ICANN will decide for that scenario, because most of the guidance to date doesn't provide any advice on what will happen. The expert determination is the final step in the process, but ICANN is updating rules, and maybe it will provide further guidance as we get closer to the expert determination.
Very good. Well, we're going to wrap things up there. Folks who want more information can visit Deborah and Chris at thepattenbogs.com website. That'll do it for Capital Thinking this week. I hope everyone has a great weekend. We'll see you back here next week for more Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.